This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. This story is from our episode, The Miracle and Menace of Plastic. Subscribe to The Pulse wherever you get your podcasts. It's easy to see plastic and feel down about it, think it's cheap or bad. And in that, we tend to forget how much plastic changed every aspect of our modern lives. Peter Crimmins has this look at plastic and design.
I'm here at home in my kitchen, and I want to show you something. I have here a vintage mid-century casserole dish. It's made of iron, and it's coated with enamel. This, back in the day, is what people both cooked food in and stored food in. It has a lid that sort of fits loosely like this. It's not airtight. It's really heavy. It's not something you would want to schlep around to a potluck and put that away. Now, this here is a plastic storage tub. Drop the lid there, and you know what this sounds like. Here you go. It's airtight. It doesn't leak. The food won't dry out in the refrigerator, and if you drop it, it's not going to crack like enamel or not going to shatter like glass. It's also really colorful. This one is a deep red, but you can just get them in any color you want. When plastic entered the home in a big way after World War II, it introduced all new options in both function and style.
It was really novel.
That's Sarah Archer. She's a design historian and the author of The Mid-Century Kitchen.
For years and years and years, kitchens really had been either kind of wood and cast iron, kind of going way back in the 19th century, or in the 19-teens and 20s, kind of sterile, like an old-fashioned doctor's office, kind of white enamel on black metal. The idea of being able to introduce sort of a fashion color, like pink or turquoise, was thrilling. It was sort of the beginning of understanding the kitchen as a place where you can entertain, and having that room in a fun color was part of the changing landscape of the home itself.
Now let's go to a little town in New Jersey where things are really popping. Yes, there's a party going on at Mrs. Betty Martin's house. It's a Tupperware party, and it's really fun.
Tupperware was created by a guy named Earl Tupper. He was a chemical engineer with DuPont, and he was looking on how to repurpose polyethylene slag. That's a waste product from oil refineries, and he figured out it could be made into flexible plastic that burps.
At one side. Hear that? That's Tupperware's airtight promise to lock in flavor and lock out air.
Tupper left DuPont and started his own company in 1948 to make Tupperware, and he turned to a marketer from Florida named Brownie Wise, who had a novel way to sell it.
They started planning Tupperware parties. Plastic, as you know, all of us know when we open a new shower curtain liner or get into a new car, plastic has a smell. And for people in the 1940s and 50s, it was totally alien. Nobody knew what this was. Tupperware parties were a place for people to see the products demoed, see all the sort of fashion colors that were available, the pinks and turquoises, and kind of smell it and see that it was, air quotes, safe, as of course we know now that plastic is not exactly without risk or without consequence. But at the time, it was kind of a way for people to get used to the material and just have it become part of life.
While Tupperware and similar plastic products were aggressively marketed to women in the home, plastic also sold itself. It was modern, it was novel, it was colorful, and it seemed to be just magical. People even wrote love songs to plastic. Cole Porter had a hit in 1934 called You're the Top. It compares a paramour to a list of really wonderful things. The Tower of Pisa, the Mona Lisa, you're the purple light of a summer night in Spain, you're cellophane.
Purple light of a summer night in Spain. You're the National Gallery, you're Garbo Sally, you're cellophane.
In the 1950s, plastic also entered the home through toys. Consider Hasbro, a toy company founded in 1923 just outside Providence, Rhode Island, by the brothers Halal and Henry Hassenfeld.
Hey, it's Hasbro. Hasbro makes toys.
The brothers' first big hit came in the 1950s with Mr. Potato Head.
See, Mr. Potato Head has a car and boat trailer.
The original Mr. Potato Head was literally a potato. The kit was sold as a set of plastic parts that your kids would stick into an actual tuber.
Take any fruit or vegetable. Just stick in eyes, then ears, and then the mouth.
They soon realized that the actual potato part was maybe not so smart because the potato would get lost under a couch and rot. So then they went to all plastic.
That is Wayne Miller. He's a journalist in Providence who has written two books about Hasbro. In the 1960s, the company developed a green polymer blob that kids could squish between their fingers. They called it Flubber, a tie-in to a popular movie at the time called The Absent-Minded Professor. It starred Fred McMurray.
I'm not sure what we've got here, Charlie. But if we've got what I think we've got, we've got...
Kids started playing with it and began breaking out with all body rashes. There was something in that material that caused a toxic reaction. And so they had to recall it all, and it nearly sank the company, literally. It was such a horrible mistake that they had made.
Hasbro yanked Flubber off the shelves in 1963, but had a hard time getting rid of it. They tried to bury it and burn it, but no municipality would let them do it on their property. They tried to sink it in a lake, but Flubber floats. Ultimately, Hasbro dug a deep hole on its own property in Rhode Island, dumped the Flubber into it, and paved it over as a parking lot. Hasbro no longer fabricates plastic toys in Rhode Island. That's all been moved overseas. But it still prototypes toys there and continues to be a big economic engine in that area. The Hasbro factory influenced artist Jonathan Santoro. He grew up near the plant in the suburbs of Providence when they were still churning out plastic toys in the 1980s. Jonathan makes installation art. He creates objects out of plastic and installs them as a tableau that tells some kind of story.
Think about these kind of staging toy sets. This kind of play, I feel like, is like something I've learned as a child.
Jonathan has mixed feelings about plastic.
And I guess I'm trying to like negotiate my feelings where something so mass-produced can elicit personal joy.
On the one hand, plastic is a byproduct of mass consumerism, and on the other hand, plastic makes his pieces so alluring.
They kind of take you in with the sheen or the color, and there's kind of a siren's call to it. My work often gets damaged because people, they want to touch it.
Jonathan's work speaks to our love-hate relationship with plastic. These days, many people have an aversion to plastic. There's a long list of reasons plastic consumer products might be problematic, but they are myriad design options, colors, forms, and functions that we have come to associate with quality of life, with convenience and newness. Think about the feeling of sitting in a brand new car and the smell of it. There are air fresheners you can buy with that new car smell to bring you back to that feeling of being in something fresh and new. What is it that we're smelling?
It's the plasticizer or the softener that's in the plastic.
Ron Kander is a polymer scientist and dean of the Canbar College of Design at Thomas Jefferson University in Philadelphia.
Your dashboard is made out of vinyl. It's brittle. The reason your dashboard feels like leather is small molecules that are put into the plastic to soften it. That new car smell is the plasticizers evaporating out of the plastic.
Americans were taught to like that smell of plastic at the first Tupperware party in 1949, and now, for better or worse, we still think plastic is fantastic.